Well, it's nice to see so many old friends here. This is actually quite an occasion. We are really delighted and excited that Jeff is going to deliver his verdict now on British industry, its fall and its rise. As you probably know, those of you who have followed this work, or even if you've just seen the size of the book outside, this has been a massive project involving detailed studies of 10 industries in 3 countries, as well as the national institutions of those countries, from the financial system to the trade unions. Most of this work was done by Jeff when he was in the Centre for Economic Performance, before he moved to the Institute of Management. And I'd like to say that it was a tremendous for us to have Jeff in the centre. We learnt an enormous amount from him, and thank you very much, Jeff, for all you did for the centre. Now, I think everybody knows that before he came to LSE, Jeff was for many years a very distinguished editor of the Financial Times, and earlier on its industrial editor, but he did also get his hands dirty. From 68 to 73, he worked first in the Industrial Reorganisation Commission, and then in British Leyland, and somewhere then, or perhaps earlier, he developed this passion and fascination for how industry actually works, and that's what you're going to see in his talk. Jeff.
Thank you very much, Richard. As Richard mentioned, I spent most of my career with the Financial Times. In fact, I started writing about industry for the FT in 1958. One of my areas of special expertise was the typewriter industry. And not so much is heard about that industry nowadays. At that time, the mood in Britain was just beginning to change from a kind of post-war smugness to growing anxiety about why we, having won the war, were doing less well economically than the countries which had lost it. Some of the senior citizens in this audience may recall a book written in the early 60s by Michael Shanks, a colleague of mine on the Financial Times. It was called The Stagnant Society, and it lashed into the failings of British managers, British trade union leaders, British politicians, practically everything else British. And the tendency at that time was to look across the channel for solutions. If only we had indicative planning like the French, or big state holding companies like the Italians, or universal banks like the Germans, then all our problems would be solved. When we tried some of those recipes, they didn't work all that well. And then there was a vogue for cultural explanations. It was all the fault of anti-industrial values propagated at the public schools and Oxbridge, and nobody quite knew what to do about that. Well, I think now, some 40 years later, one can see these things in a clearer perspective. There were indeed problems in the 50s and 60s, and they got worse in the 70s, but they were not irremediable. The turning point came in the 1980s when policies changed and British industrial performance improved. After a long period in which we'd lagged behind our continental competitors, we began to catch up, and it wasn't just a matter of closing down obsolete factories and getting rid of overmanning. In a number of sectors, there was an injection of new investment, some of it coming from overseas. British industry as a whole went through a painful process of integrating itself into the world market. And the effect was to halt the decline in our share of world exports and to raise average standards of efficiency closer to the best international levels. Now, what I'm trying to do this evening is to describe how and why this recovery took place. And I want to start by looking at the reasons for the earlier lag. Was it a continuation of a decline that had started 100 years or so earlier, or was it due to things done or not done in the post-war period itself? Some historians have argued that the rot set in the closing decades of the 19th century. British entrepreneurs, having led the world in the first Industrial Revolution, were no match for their German and American competitors in the second. Part of the problem, according to this line of argument, was institutional inertia. The education system was poorly equipped to support the new science-based industries which were coming to the fore at that time. The financial system was incapable of assembling the large amounts of risk capital which these new industries needed. The labor relations system was characterized by strong trade unions, most of which had originated as craft-based job protection societies. Their restrictionist attitudes are said to have obstructed the introduction of new production methods. It's certainly true that Germany and the US developed capabilities that were different from those on which Britain's earlier success had been based. But this had more to do with the timing and character of industrialization in those two countries than with the shortcomings of British entrepreneurs or the rigidity of its institutions. And if you look at the three of the major technologies of the Second Industrial Revolution, there's not so much to be ashamed of in the British record. German firms got ahead in synthetic dyestuffs, later pharmaceuticals, partly because of the investments which Prussia and other German states had made in the education of scientists and engineers. But remember that the US was as backward as Britain at that stage in this new technique of synthetic organic chemistry. The dyestuff story is more a uniquely German triumph than a uniquely British failure. And there was a partial recovery in the interwar years. ICI, like DuPont in the US, imitated the German approach to company-financed research. The discovery of polythene by ICI, like that of nylon by DuPont, showed that by the end of the 30s, the German chemical companies no longer had the field to themselves. In electrical engineering, no British firm before 1914 came close to the four world leaders, General Electric and Westinghouse in the US, Siemens and AEG in Germany. But here too, there was quite a respectable recovery in the interwar years. GEC, English Electric and others were beginning to catch up. And there was a promising start in the new field of electronics, the development of television by EMI and Marconi being a notable British success. Mass production, of course, was an American invention, and by 1914, the US was producing more cars than all the European countries put together. There was nothing that any of the European manufacturers could have done to prevent the Americans from extending their lead in the interwar years. But by European standards, British entrepreneurs did pretty well, skillfully modifying American techniques to the very different conditions of the British market. Austin and Morris were technically and managerially at least on a par with their French and German counterparts. The Austin 7, some perhaps a bit ironically in the light of recent events, was made under license in Germany by a company which later became part of BMW. If you look at old industries as well as new, the response of British entrepreneurs to German and American competition up to the Second World War was patchy, but by no means disastrous, and certainly not bad enough to suggest that an irreversible decline had set in. As for institutions, the provision of technical and scientific education had been greatly enlarged. The gap between finance and industry, the City of London industry, which had been the subject of much complaint before 1914, was partially closed. And even the labor relations system, which had gone through a period of turbulence before and after the First World War had acquired by the end of the 30s a degree of stability with which both sides of industry seemed broadly content. The legacy of history did not condemn British industry to inevitable decline after 1945. The relevant question then is, what did we do wrong after 1945? Or, looking at it in a different way, what did Germany and France have in common which might explain their superior performance? Both countries had suffered more damage than Britain during the war, so they were starting from a lower base. It wasn't surprising that once the damage had been repaired, they should enjoy some years of exceptionally rapid recovery. And another difference was that Germany and France had larger agricultural sectors. As economic growth gathered pace, they could transfer labor from low productivity agriculture into high productivity industry, a transition which Britain had gone through many years before. But these two factors are not enough to explain how the two continental countries converted post-war reconstruction into a sustained period of economic growth which left Britain trailing some way behind. This was not a continuation of pre-war trends. Something had changed to give the continental countries a lift which was missing in Britain. Now, to establish just what had changed, it's appropriate to start with Germany, since it was there that the break with the past was most complete. The policies introduced by Ludwig Erhard marked a decisive shift away from the cartelization, protectionism, and autarky of the pre-war years. The promotion of competition was at the heart of the ordo-liberal philosophy, and it was to be achieved by vigorous action against price-fixing, market-sharing agreements at home, and by the liberalization of foreign trade. The Federal Republic was the pace-setter among European countries in reducing tariffs during the 1950s. Import penetration rose rapidly alongside the spectacular expansion of exports. Macroeconomic policy was governed by a set of rules which limited the scope for discretionary government intervention. The focus was on encouraging private sector investment without direction from the center. In France, the break with the past took a different form. A central priority for post-war governments was industrial modernization, driven by the desire to correct the weaknesses which were held responsible for the debacle of 1940. The motivation was as much political as economic, and it was linked from 1947 onwards to the search for a new relationship with Germany. And this led in 1951 to the European Coal and Steel Community, a first step towards European integration. But the really crucial event for French industry was the opening of the common market. Shaking manufacturers out of their protectionist cocoon and forcing them to compete with the Germans in a large tariff-free market. Both countries benefited enormously from the rapid expansion of intra-European trade that followed. And for French industry in particular, exposure to Europe-wide competition was far more important in stimulating higher productivity than indicative planning or industrial policy, two things which were much admired in Britain at that time. By opting out of European integration, Britain deprived itself of this stimulus. Most exporters continued to rely on non-European, especially Commonwealth markets, as they had done before the war. And to make matters worse, the promotion of competition, whether through trade liberalization or by attacking anti-competitive practices at home, was not a high priority for post-war governments. The overriding objectives were full employment and social peace. That was the consensus which had been forged during the war, and both major political parties were anxious to preserve it. Even when the great reappraisal of policy began in the early 1960s, the wrong lessons were learnt from the success of the continental countries. Although legislation on cartels had been strengthened by the Restrictive Practices Act of 1956, industrial policy over the next two decades was largely geared not to the promotion of competition, but to a futile program of industrial intervention, the creation of national champions in supposedly strategic industries, and an extension of public ownership. The worst excesses came under Labour, but the Conservative record in industrial policy before 1979 was not a glorious one. What happened in two high-profile industries illustrates the effect of these policies: steel and cars. Between 1945 and 1967, the steel industry was protected and regulated much as it had been in the 1930s. An invitation to join the European Coal and Steel Community was rejected by the Attlee government, mainly on political grounds. Ministers did not want to lose control over what they saw as the commanding heights of the economy. The steelmakers, for their part, were busy selling to their traditional customers and had no great enthusiasm for opening the domestic market to European competition. Prices were controlled by a government agency, and politicians took a close interest in the industry's investment decisions. Some of you may recall Harold Macmillan's famous Judgment of Solomon in 1958, when the location of a big new steelworks, the fourth continuous wide strip mill, was being considered. In order to appease the regional lobbies, Macmillan split the project between Scotland and South Wales, thus saddling the steel industry with two suboptimal plants. As one commentator wrote at the time, the greatest economic advantage would be sacrificed deliberately in the interests of immediate social comfort and convenience. Nationalization, which came in 67, made the industry even more vulnerable to political interference. British Steel Corporation embarked on an overambitious expansion strategy at a time when an incremental program of efficiency improvement would have been more appropriate. And its response to the mid-1970s slump in steel demand was more sluggish than it would have been if it had been in the private sector. By the end of the decade, the productivity gap with Germany was probably wider in steel than in any other major industry. The motor industry, because of the importance of economies of scale, was damaged more than most by Britain's isolation from continental Europe. For the first 15 years after the war, most of the industry's exports went to non-European markets. By the mid-60s, when British Motor Corporation, BMC, which was the largest British-owned car manufacturer, began redirecting its exports towards continental Europe, Volkswagen, Renault, and others had already pulled ahead, and British exports now had to climb over the EEC's common external tariff. Labour relations were deteriorating, and a difficult situation was made worse by government intervention. The creation of British Leyland in 1968 must rank as one of the worst industrial policy decisions of the post-war era, matched only by the manner in which the company was rescued 7 years later. By 1980, British Leyland was close to collapse, and the rest of the industry was contracting fast. The motor industry was an extreme case, and it's wrong to think of British industrial performance between the 50s and the end of the 70s as uniformly bad. In pharmaceuticals, for example, British firms did rather well, and it's worth considering why that should have been so. The pharmaceutical firms unlike the car makers, were not seriously damaged by non-membership of the EEC. Because of differing national regulations, there was no unified market in drugs, and British firms were no worse placed than their French and German counterparts in selling throughout Europe. Labour relations were generally stable, partly because of the production process, high-value items produced in small quantities in small plants. And finally, the pharmaceutical industry had the great good fortune of never being regarded by governments as strategic. And there was no attempt by governments to push all the British-owned firms into a single national champion. Now, in emphasizing the importance of European trade in the early post-war decades, I don't want to sound like a propagandist for the Britain in Europe campaign. I'm certainly not suggesting that earlier entry into the common market would have cured all our problems. There were some industries which declined for reasons which had nothing whatever to do with Europe. In shipbuilding, for example, other forces were at work, notably the rise of Japan and later South Korea. It's worth noting, though, although British yards were hit particularly hard, none of the other European shipbuilding nations did much better over the post-war period as a whole. But in most of manufacturing industry, large chunks of manufacturing industry, a difficult adjustment had to be made from empire to Europe. And the shift occurred more slowly than it needed to have done, partly because of choices made by managers, partly because of government policy. As long as firms could make adequate profits by selling to their traditional customers, as many of them did until the early 70s, there was no great incentive to change. But in the second half of that decade, a series of shocks exposed weaknesses which had been more easily tolerated in the earlier post-war years. Greater import competition following entry into the EEC, the rise of Japan and the newly industrializing countries, the slowdown in the world economy after the quadrupling of world oil prices. A growing number of industrial companies saw that they had to make radical changes in strategy and in their internal organization if they were to survive. At this point, Margaret Thatcher enters the picture. Thatcherism represented a break with the past, almost as complete as Erhard's reforms in Germany 30 years earlier. The new priorities were competition, deregulation, privatization within a macroeconomic framework which stressed price stability rather than full employment. The concept of national champions, at least outside the field of defense and aerospace, was scrapped. At the same time, labor relations reform was tackled with a degree of firmness and tactical skill which had eluded previous governments. The days of wishful thinking were over. In the case of steel, the government subjected British Steel Corporation to strict financial disciplines with a view to eventual privatization. Capacity was cut back in line with realistic estimates of future demand, and the efficiency of the plants that remained was improved through changes in working practices. After a lengthy strike in 1980, in which the government, contrary to previous practice, did not intervene, relations with labor were put onto a new footing. The problem of inter-union rivalry, which had dogged the industry since the 1950s, was largely dealt with by plant-level negotiations with representatives of the workforce as a whole. And on the marketing side, strenuous efforts were made to build up sales in continental Europe, now seen as vital to the company's future. By the 1990s, the privatized British Steel was one of the most efficient steelmakers in Europe. Recovery in cars was more difficult, not least because British Leyland, or Rover, as it was renamed in 1987, had failed to establish itself on the continent. That's the problem which the new owners of the company, BMW, are now trying to put right. Fortunately, the industry is no longer as dependent as it was on the one-time national champion. Some three-quarters of British car exports now come from the three Japanese companies which established assembly plants in Britain, and from the three older foreign subsidiaries owned by Ford, General Motors, and Peugeot, all of which have greatly improved their quality and efficiency. Margaret Thatcher arrived in Downing Street at a time when cross-border investment, the phenomenon sometimes known as globalization, was accelerating. As Britain became a more attractive manufacturing location, the flow of inward investment increased. And a striking example was the transformation of the paper industry, paper-making industry. Whereas in the 1960s, this industry was dominated by long-established British-owned manufacturers such as Reed and Bowater, a large part of it is now in the hands of foreign firms, mainly Swedish, Finnish, and American. The surviving British firms chose to specialize in areas where they had a competitive advantage, which was mostly grades based on waste paper or high value-added specialities. And the outcome, as in cars, has been an impressive increase in output, exports, and productivity. And in both industries, the transition has involved closer integration with continental Europe. In 1960, 25% of British car exports went to other European countries. In 1990, the figure was 86%. Now, the extent of the recovery and the role played by non-British companies varied from industry to industry, depending on how much ground had already been lost and on the economics of the industry concerned. I'm not claiming that a miraculous rejuvenation took place, still less that British industry regained the position that it had occupied, say, in 1950. That was hardly realistic. British firms were forced to adjust to what had become a more open and more crowded world market, concentrating on businesses which could be made internationally competitive and withdrawing from those which could not. Some of these withdrawals, for example, in the manufacture of television sets, were offset by foreign companies which built or acquired factories in Britain. This process of specialization and internationalization was driven by a combination of external economic pressure and domestic policy reform, and the result was a very considerable improvement in performance. Where does this version of events leave institutional or cultural explanations of British industrial decline? Taking the financial system first, the usual criticisms have been that capital, especially long-term capital, has not been available in the right amounts or on the right terms, and that banks and other financial institutions have been too detached from the needs of industrial companies. On the first, it's really quite hard to see how British industry's loss of ground in the first 30 years after the war can be ascribed to a shortage of capital. If there was a weakness during that period, it was that large established companies found it almost too easy to raise finance without sufficient scrutiny from banks or shareholders as to how the money was to be spent. When Frank Kearton, chairman of Courtaulds, tried to modernize the textile industry in the 1960s, he had no difficulty in raising the funds for a pretty ambitious, large-scale program of acquisitions and new factories. The fact that Kirtan's grand design was based on a misconception of how the European textile market was going to evolve and had to be unscrambled by his successors was not the fault of the financial system. The problem that was not that capital was in short supply, but that too much of it was used unproductively. The other criticism raises the hoary question of short-termism and the allegedly excessive reliance on hostile takeovers as a means of correcting managerial failure. Some commentators have argued that hostile takeovers are costly and disruptive, frequently fail to achieve the objectives set by their promoters, and are often directed against the wrong targets. They also encourage managers to focus on maintaining or increasing profits in the short term at the expense of longer term strategies. In Germany, on the other hand, hostile takeovers are extremely rare, and this has been seen as a competitive advantage for German industry. There's no clear evidence that hostile takeovers damaged British industry in the first 30 years after the war. In the sectors which did particularly badly during those years, such as shipbuilding, cars, machine tools, hostile bids, actual or threatened, were rare. Most of the mergers which took place in these and other industries were agreed transactions, some of them encouraged by governments. The promoters of these mergers can be criticized for exaggerating the advantages of size and synergy, but that can hardly be blamed on the financial system. One of the few big mergers that worked well, GEC's acquisition of AEI in 1967, came about through a contested takeover. That deal set in train a much needed rationalization of the electrical industry and helped to create a strong British electrical electronics group. British industry might have benefited from more hostile bids of that sort rather than less. The second post-war merger wave, starting in the mid-80s, involved hostile bids on a larger scale. This was the heyday of the acquisitive predators led by Hansen and BTR, which targeted diversified groups with a view either to breaking them up or managing the assets more effectively. On balance, these activities made a helpful contribution to the efficiency of British industry. A notable example was the impact on ICI of the takeover approach from Hansen in 1992. Although Hansen in the end didn't make a bid, its intervention precipitated changes, perhaps brought forward changes in ICI, including the demerger of the pharmaceutical business, which were desirable on industrial and financial grounds. It is surely not a coincidence that the improvement in British industrial performance occurred at the same time as capital markets became more demanding and the takeover market more active. Pressure from this source reinforced the pressure that was coming from the product market. If hostile takeovers induce a short-term mentality on the part of industrial managers, the effects might be expected to be particularly damaging in industries which demand long-term investment in research and development. Could this explain the relatively weak performance of British firms in electronics? Well, that would be more plausible if long-termist Germany had done well in this industry, but it hasn't. The US, on the other hand, where takeover market is even more active than in Britain, has done well, has a very strong electronics industry. So too does Japan, where hostile takeovers are as rare as in Germany. Another research-intensive industry, pharmaceuticals, presents a different picture. Long-termist Germany and short-termist Britain have done well. Long-termist Japan has not. These examples seem to suggest that the financial system on its own doesn't have a decisive influence on which countries succeed in particular industries, although it may play a supporting role. America's large and sophisticated venture capital industry has undoubtedly contributed to the growth of new entrepreneurial firms in semiconductors and computers. But this was only one of the factors underpinning US success in this field. The size and rapid growth of domestic demand, especially in the 50s and 60s when those two industries were in their formative phase, were much more crucial. It wasn't lack of support from the city that prevented the emergence of British firms comparable to Digital Equipment Corporation or Apple Computer and the others in the US. No German or French counterparts to those firms emerged as well. Turning now to the second institutional culprit, training and education. Much of the debate in recent years has centered on Britain's deficiencies in shop floor skills, especially in comparison with Germany. Whereas the German apprenticeship system has been remarkably resilient throughout the post-war period, in Britain the number of apprentices began to fall in the second half of the 60s and the decline accelerated in subsequent decades. Attempts by the government to halt the decline or replace apprenticeship with other forms of training have had only mixed success. That the apprenticeship system has been a source of strength for German industry is not in doubt. The question is whether deficiencies in vocational training should be regarded as a distinctively British weakness. Britain's relative industrial decline, as measured by productivity growth, shares of world exports, was most marked in the 50s and 60s, when the apprenticeship system was in reasonable working order, and Britain was losing ground not only to Germany, but to other European countries whose vocational training arrangements at that time were not hugely superior to those of Britain. And if you look at individual industries, it doesn't appear, except in one very important case, that an inadequate supply of workforce skills was central to the industrial failures of the early post-war years. The fact that productivity in steel fell behind Germany, or that Kirtan's grand design for textiles didn't work, or that the motorcycle makers couldn't cope with Japanese competition, none of that can be blamed on deficiencies in the training system. Nor has the issue of shop floor skills figured prominently in the numerous studies of the post-war motor industry. The exception is mechanical engineering, and particularly the more skill-intensive branches of that industry, where the German firms have been exceptionally strong. The manufacture of complex, technically sophisticated machinery produced in small batches suits the skill profile of the German workforce, based on this combination of theoretical knowledge and in-depth practical know-how. British firms have been less successful in those manufacturing processes, hence the decline in such fields as machine tools or textile machinery. But other industrial countries have fared almost as badly. The decline of the American machine tool industry in the 70s and 80s has been blamed on much the same weaknesses in vocational training that have been the subject of so much criticism in Britain. French firms have also done poorly in those sectors. None of this shows that British industry wouldn't have benefited from a thorough reform of vocational training after the war. British firms certainly did better in industries like chemicals, which depended on university-trained scientists, than in industries such as machine tools, which depended more on skilled craftsmen. But these deficiencies don't appear to have been a major cause of the productivity lag in the early post-war decades, nor did they prevent the catch-up that took place in the 80s. Now, there's a separate charge against the education system, and it relates to what many people regard as the most important single cause of British industrial weakness: the poor quality of the country's managers. Now, this criticism comes in two parts: that Britain's schools and universities, infected by a social and intellectual bias against industry, discouraged talented young people from taking up careers in industrial management, and that those who did go into industry and reach senior executive positions were inadequately trained for the job. This notion of an anti-industrial culture was popularized a few years ago by an American historian, Martin Wiener. He argued that in the 19th century, British entrepreneurs went through a process of gentrification, which had a long-term debilitating effect on industrial performance. Eager to become part of the ruling elite, businessmen sent their sons to public schools where they studied classics, played team games, and absorbed the anti-industrial values of the aristocracy. Now, my own background might be thought to support this line of argument. I went to Rugby and Balliol, studied classics, and spent a great deal of my time playing team games. As those of you who've been watching the World Cup might be aware, rugby is the school where William Webb Ellis first picked up the ball and ran with it. When I left university, I had the choice of working for ICI in Billingham, on the northeast of England, or for the Financial Times in London. I chose the FT, not because I thought that working for a newspaper was more gentlemanly than working for a chemical company. I simply thought that my tennis was more likely to improve in London than in Billingham. I'm not quite sure what sociological implications should be drawn from that, but leaving that question aside, Wiener's thesis has been pretty effectively demolished by other historians, to the extent that he was trying to explain why British entrepreneurs failed between 1870 and 1914, a dubious proposition in itself. The public schools can't be given the weight that he attaches to them, since a very small proportion of businessmen sent their sons to public schools during those years, and most of those who did go to public school followed the same careers as their father, and that continued to be the case after the turn of the century. Moreover, a public school background did not necessarily imply an amateurish approach to management. It wasn't uncommon for public school boys, if they didn't go on to university, to undergo some form of technical training, perhaps as a premium apprentice in an industrial company. Leonard Lord, who was a major figure in the interwar motor industry, was one of many who followed that route. And there was also a gradual broadening of the public school's curriculum, more emphasis on science and technology, and that continued after 1945. As for the neglect of management education, it's true that the professionalization of management came later in Britain than in the US and took a different form. Unlike American giants like General Electric and United States Steel Corporation, most British companies up to the First World War were small enough not to need complex managerial hierarchies. With the trend towards mergers, larger companies in the 20s and 30s, there was a greater need for professional executives. Some universities began to offer courses in business administration, and the leading engineering institutions introduced training in management as part of the qualification for membership. And another source of management expertise was the accountancy profession. by 1931, about a third of all chartered accountants worked in business, and several of the country's leading industrialists had an accountancy background. In the absence of business schools, accountancy was one of the best available routes into general management. After the war, despite widespread admiration for all things American, US-style management education was slow to take root, and it wasn't until the 1960s that the first business schools were established at London and Manchester, and then others followed suit. Would British industry have done better if management education had, if this expansion of management education had taken place earlier? The German example suggests that American-style business schools weren't a necessary condition for economic success. The distinctive feature of German management has been the predominance of technical qualifications among senior executives. Some people in Britain think that what was wrong was not that we weren't like the Americans, but that we undervalued technical competence as a qualification for senior posts. A particular cause for complaint, especially among engineers, was the presence of so many accountants in boardrooms. But there are historical reasons for the special role played by accountants in British industry, and there's no reason to believe that the consequences have been bad for efficiency. It's as easy to find examples of companies which have been run well by accountants, Glaxo under Paul Girolami, or Guest, Keene and Nettlefolds under Trevor Holdsworth, as it is to find companies which have been mismanaged by engineers, British Motor Corporation. Is the quality of management then irrelevant as a source of British industrial weakness? Many companies were badly run in the early post-war decades, but that had much more to do with soft markets than with an anti-industrial culture or the absence of business schools. And even in those years, there were some outstanding executives, people like H.G. Lazelle at Beecham, Arnold Weinstock at GEC, Patrick Hennessy at Ford. As competition increased in the 70s and 80s, more such managers rose to the top of their companies. People like John Harvey Jones at ICI, Christopher Hogg at Courtaulds, Roger Hearn at Smith's Industries. And they were reinforced by a sprinkling of talent from overseas. The idea that Britain has been cursed by uniquely incompetent and undynamic managers finds little support from a study of the post-war period. What then of British trade unions? The third and perhaps most plausible of the usual suspects. Everyone accepts that labour relations in Britain deteriorated in the 60s and 70s. Strikes, restrictive practices, widely seen as part of the British disease. Most of these weaknesses were removed in the 80s and 90s. The taming of the trade unions is often seen as Margaret Thatcher's greatest achievement. What remains a matter of controversy is the amount of damage caused by unreformed labour relations between 1945 and 1980. The most visible aspect of the deterioration was the frequency of strikes, especially unofficial strikes. But it's important to remember that the vast majority of workers in manufacturing industry were hardly affected by strikes in the 60s and 70s. Of the major manufacturing industries, the most strike-prone were motor vehicles, especially cars, and shipbuilding. Both were assembly-type industries with large concentrations of labour on a single site. Both were affected by what has probably been the most serious structural problem within the British system, multiple unionism. Even in those two cases, however, labour relations were by no means the sole cause of competitive decline. British Leyland's failure to develop cars suitable for the European market can't be blamed on Red Robbo and his fellow shop stewards. And the fact that the shipbuilders missed out on the oil tanker boom in the early years was not the fault of trade unions. In terms of damage to the economy, strikes were less important than inefficiency in the use of labour. How far this can be blamed on trade unions is debatable. Some restrictive practices, for example, those arising from demarcations between crafts, had their origin in agreements between employers and unions, which were entirely rational when first introduced, but were made obsolete by changing technology. The fact that they persisted for so long was due as much to the acquiescence of employers as to the obstinacy of trade unions. Other practices, bad timing, bad timekeeping, excessive tea breaks, and so on, were the result of lax management rather than trade union power. The easy markets of the early post-war years, together with a political climate which discouraged confrontation with unions, allowed both types of inefficiency to be more solidly, to get more solidly entrenched. The critical change in the 1980s was that these practices were no longer affordable. As domestic and international competition increased, reform of work organization became essential to corporate survival. The confidence of managers in driving through the necessary reforms was increased by the weakness of unions, due partly to high unemployment and partly to the Thatcher government's legislation. Would British industry have performed better if trade union legislation of this sort had been introduced in the 1950s rather than the 1980s? Comparisons are often drawn with Germany, West Germany, where labour relations, which had been quite adversarial in the interwar years, were extensively reformed soon after the formation of the Federal Republic. But France, which also outperformed Britain, did not reform its labour relations system. Although the trade unions in France were never as powerful as in Britain, labour relations were almost as confrontational, and the strike record, at least in the 50s, early 60s, was not much better. Labour relations reform, desirable though it would have been, would not in itself have transformed British industrial performance. The significance of Thatcherism lay in the package as a whole, not the trade union legislation in isolation. To summarise, then, I've tried to argue that in explaining what went wrong in British industry after 1945, pride of place should be given to policy errors rather than institutional weaknesses inherited from the past. The two biggest mistakes were to opt out of European economic integration in the 1950s and to give insufficient priority to competition as the principal driver of higher productivity. What we could have done with in the early post-war years, if you will forgive what may seem an extreme contradiction in terms, was a pro-European Margaret Thatcher. But as she herself might have said, the time was not ripe for such a figure to emerge. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. What a tour de force. What a wide canvas, and so much detail as well. I'm not sure that you didn't manage to give a good send-off to the Britain and Europe campaign, but still that'll emerge from the questions. Who would like to ask the first question or make the first comment? Well, yes. There's a mic.
You mentioned British management, but there's quite a few studies like Dalton and O'Mahony, a match plant comparison with West Germany, where she said that British management was poor in its human relations approach and that it lacked certain technical skills which would have enabled it to keep its plant running at high rates of efficiency and lessen breakdowns. And I wondered if you, what you thought of these studies, because you did mention management.
Well, in making comparisons between specific British industries and specific German ones, I couldn't find a great deal of evidence to support those comparisons. I mean, in some industries, as I mentioned, like certain areas of mechanical engineering, there's no question that, that German performance was superior to British performance. But in others, such as chemicals and pharmaceuticals, it's not obvious that there was a managerial lag in Britain compared to Germany.
Yes, thank you very much for everything I learned this evening. As a French person, I was really surprised to see that after the Second World War, that was more difficult for the UK than for Germany in France. That was a big surprise for me. Now I would like the future of it. What kind of conclusions do you draw for Britain tomorrow, for the euro, for the way the single market should work? What next?
Well, I would think that without sort of exaggerating it, I think that the Thatcherization of Britain and the non-Thatcherization of France and Germany has given us some advantage. Sorry. That the Thatcherization of Britain and non-Thatcherization of France and Germany has given us certain advantages. And that, you know, as everybody talks about, there is a degree of flexibility which is lacking in some areas of the continent. I think that I take no view, at least not about Britain and the euro. All I would say is that as far as manufacturing industry is concerned, which is mainly what I've been looking at, integration with Europe is a fact. And many British manufacturing firms derive more of their business from France and Germany than they do from the UK, and that is unlikely to change.
What about the airline industry, the British airline industry? What do you predict?
Well, I'm not an expert on the airline industry at all, and I think it's a rather peculiar industry which remains perhaps one of the few where the national champion concept still seems to apply. I even saw an interview with the British Airways people the other day about European competition and threat from Lufthansa and so on and so on, which seemed to imply that the British government should support British Airways because it is the national champion in the airline industry, which seemed to me a rather strange throwback to the 1960s. But it's a very odd industry. I mean, I presume that in due course, Heathrow will get somehow or other opened up and liberalization will take place. I think when it does, if and when it does take place, I see no reason why British Airways shouldn't be able to compete quite effectively. But it seems to be a lot of obstacles before that industry becomes a normal industry.
Thank you. Would you say that the British legislation against anti-competitive practices, which was intensified after the 1956 Act, either didn't go far enough or wasn't sufficiently vigorously pursued, or was not in itself sufficient to bring about the major changes you referred to without the other factors?
I think it was not sufficient in itself to bring about the changes. I mean, I think it did make a difference, no question about that, and lots of those cartels were unwound. Maybe it was offset a bit by merger activity in the 60s. But I think it needed, I mean, I think if you make the comparison with Germany, as competition, stimulus to competition came much more from trade liberalization than from the anti-cartel legislation in Germany, although the anti-cartel legislation was not insignificant. And I suppose way I think about it, if you look at the car industry, for example, I can't remember the exact figures, but I think in the late 60s, still only about 5% of the British market was supplied by imports, whereas in Germany it was more like 25%. So I think it was an important act, that 1956 thing, but I think other things needed to happen as well.
Geoffrey, could I ask a question based on a few observations? They all revolve around this issue of the short-termism, the financial institution basis. I think I'm sort of sitting here very much agreeing with your central thesis, wondering whether you've just gone a little bit far in throwing out completely the old short-termism thesis. Though the question that I was going to ask is not head-on that. It's what should we make of the fact that so much of British manufacturing industry is foreign-owned, and does it matter at all? I mean, let me start with the observation. I mean, you've made the point that major bits of our final assembly, say, automotive manufacture, are foreign-owned. In fact, basically now the whole lot of it, now that Rover is BMW. But the observation I would make from going around the country is that what has always struck me is how many mid-sized manufacturing firms you come across which are surviving in highly competitive European markets, which are either foreign-owned themselves or have opted out of the public listed company route by going private through management buyouts or other mechanisms of defending themselves against short pressure, and who will tell you, rightly or wrongly, that those different ownership structures were important to the degree of investment required to survive. Therefore, though I'm wary of the full sort of Will Hutton, full Monty, as it were, on this, I've always had just a degree of openness to it. The question I therefore want to put is, however, whether or not this has produced a difference in real performance, it seems to be a fact that to different degrees, different countries have had different hurdle rates, different rate of return requirements. It's difficult to quite see why so much of the British utility industry is now being purchased by French utilities, unless you believe that their valuation processes produce a higher perceived value of British utilities than the UK stock market. And therefore, whether or not it's made a difference to real performance, it appears to have made a difference to ownership structures. Does that ownership structure matter at all? I mean, should we be at all worried that so much of industry is owned by companies which are headquartered outside the UK, or is that just a delusion and an old way of thinking?
I think my general feeling is that it doesn't matter. That it doesn't matter. That if you think of an industry like electronics, where the extent of foreign ownership is almost as great as in the motor industry. I'm now making comparisons with France and Germany. Has it done France any good to have preserved a nationally owned TV set manufacturer through thick and thin, or indeed a nationally owned computer manufacturer through thick and thin over the past 3 years? Has it really brought any sort of spin-off benefits to the rest of French industry? And again, I think that I'm impressed by the fact that in Germany, the sort of home of long-termism, things seem to be moving in a more Anglo-American direction. And again, if you look at Siemens, you know, has it been good for Siemens, good for the German economy, that they soldiered on for 25 years or whatever in the semiconductor business before finally deciding last year or the year before that enough was enough? I mean, British firms are under pressure to deal promptly with poorly performing businesses, and that's perhaps one of the factors why many of them have sold out. But I'm not persuaded that that's damaging to the economy. You remember that period when people used to think we must have our indigenously owned manufacturer of semiconductors. And, I think that it's hard to argue that that has now become a sort of global supply industry, and the fact that our semiconductor makers, or sort of high volume ones, are owned by foreign companies, I don't think is damaging.
I want to ask a question.
About education. I can imagine a number of other people who might have asked this question, but I'll ask it. I mean, I see that if you compare industries and you try to explain which industries do well and which don't in Britain, you might not make huge progress in inferring that, you know, we have a huge educational problem. But I think another way of thinking about it is comparing individuals and thinking about their wages, which is, after all, more than three quarters of national productivity. And I mean, I'm always struck by the following two facts. One is comparing Britain and Germany. If you take the top half of the German workforce, they earn very little more than the top half of the British workforce. If you take the bottom half of the German workforce, they earn 50% more than the bottom half of the British workforce. And if you then compare the education of those two halves of the workforce, the top half of the German workforce is pretty much the same education level as ours, and the bottom half totally different. And it seems to me that, you know, you may be able to get at some of these questions more by other kinds of evidence than by trying to trace it right through the productivity of particular companies. And your finding about education, which has been quite widely quoted, is very much at odds with the conventional wisdom, and I'm not sure that it can be adequately substantiated simply by looking at, you know, the productivity of industry. I don't know, what's your comment?
Well, I don't know. I suppose I was trying to argue against the sometimes exaggerated positions that deficiencies in this area are kind of all-encompassing cause of and I couldn't see that the evidence supported that. But, you know, I feel that in this area, as in some of the others, including perhaps the financial system, you know, there are plenty of reasons for not being happy with our present arrangements and wanting to improve, I don't know, supply of venture capital or whatever. I was trying to look at it in a slightly different context, you know.
Okay, last question. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could comment on the relative performance of nationalized industries between, or what your thoughts are on that between Britain and the continent, because with those industries, it seems like they're more protected from international competition just because of their national character. Certain things, for example, I'm thinking of like rail in different countries, France and Britain. That's something that the competition argument, I think, is sort of difficult, has trouble explaining.
Well, I think it is sometimes said that the French France has been better able at running these sort of government-owned industries than Britain, and perhaps because of this famous rapport between government officials and the people who run these industries. And I think of an example, not perhaps quite in the line that you were mentioning, but the nuclear power field. I think there's no question that the French, successive French governments, have handled that operation much more successfully than the British one. And there seems to be a greater consistency of policy on the part of the French bureaucrats and the French governments. On the other hand, if you think of something like Air France versus British Airways, I'm not sure the comparison would be so favorable from a French point of view. Or perhaps if you look at some of the manufacturing industries which I've looked at, like the aircraft industry. I think they've you could make a case that the French aircraft industry remains relatively high cost.
Well, I think that this has been a fascinating evening, but of course it's only the tip of the iceberg. Outside the door there are 500 pages, and this is an opportunity to congratulate Jeff on having produced such a really interesting and important book, and to say to all of you that now is your chance to buy it, and you might even get his signature if you do it quickly. Jeff, thank you very, very much.